Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscawane. The Yellowbirds by Kevin Powers is the kind of book that stays with you long after you've read the last lines. Images linger, some of them beautiful and serene, others disturbing in their violence. The fear and adrenaline rush experienced by the main characters in the novel, Privates Bartlett and Murphy, seems to seep off the pages. At the end of the book, questions remain. What really happened, and what's going to happen next? The author, Kevin Powers, served in Iraq as a machine gunner and went on to study English at Virginia Commonwealth University. He was then awarded a prestigious fellowship at the Michener Center at the University of Texas in Austin. Kevin Powers, thank you so much for being on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Kevin, you served in Iraq, as I said, in 2004, in 2005, both in Mosul and Al-Tafar. When was this book born, or the idea of it?
Probably about a year or so after I returned.
Is that when it came to you? Or
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is that when it started to come to you, or were scenes stuck with you from your own experience?
Yeah, I started thinking about my experience and trying to work through it through poetry, and images, names, sort of thematic elements just kept appearing, and I felt like I needed a larger canvas to explore those concerns that I had about my own experience, the sort of larger experience, what it meant to be a soldier in any war, in this war in particular. It was about a year or so after I got back that I really felt like I could approach the material with the kind of clarity that I was hoping for.
And you were writing poetry before you enlisted in the Army, right?
I was, yeah. No, I mean, I encountered the poems of Dylan Thomas when I was 12 or 13, and from that point on, I've always considered myself something of a poet and a writer, short stories, things like that.
What kind of a boy were you? What drew you to the Army?
I think I was quiet, a little shy. There's something of an unofficial tradition of military service in my family. My father, my uncle, both served in the military. Of course, my grandfathers, as was very common for their generation, served in the military. So there was something attractive to me about this sort of sense of adventure. It seemed like an honorable thing to do. And then when I was 17, it just seemed like the next logical step.
And how old were you when you were in Iraq?
I was 23.
23. And I mean, of course, I want to ask you about your own experience and how much it informs the writing, but were you able to write at all while you were there, other than in letters and so on?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I did, I wrote many letters home to friends, family, and things like that, and I jotted some things down in a journal, but I really didn't have the kind of extra mental energy necessary to, that I've always sort of needed to approach a poem or a story or something like that. It just, and even when I got back, I needed some time before I felt like I could approach the material the way that felt correct in a way.
Now, the main characters, as I mentioned in the book, are Private Bartle, who is a little bit older, and Private Murphy, or Murph, as he is known, who is 18 at the time. I guess, in essence, they are both good guys. What do they stand for? What are their characters?
I do think they are, at root, good people. They are young, probably a little naive. But I wanted to portray them sort of the way that I felt about my own experience and the people that I interacted with. I think it's easy to look at soldiers and just see the uniform. It can be hard to distinguish one from another, but really I wanted to focus on their individuality, the sort of ordinary nature of their lives, the fact that there wasn't anything in particular about them that was special, but the fact that that in itself was a kind of distinction, that they were regular people from a regular place.
And throughout the book, you refer to all the soldiers as boys or as girls. And you also give us that distance because the one character specifically grows older in the book and looks back. Do you seem, when you look at your 17-year-old self, do you just seem so young to yourself now?
I do, yeah. No, I mean, I'm 32 now, and I still feel relatively young, but when I look back, I'm sort of amazed at how young I was. I'm amazed at the things that I thought I understood about the world that I'm not sure that I did. And you know, when I interact with people who are that age now, I'm shocked that some of them are, you know, that it's possible that some of them could be experiencing some of the same things that I did. It seems amazing to me that happens.
And were your experiences in Iraq as traumatic as some of what you describe in the book?
Well, I mean, the specifics of what happens in the book are very different from my own experience, and certainly I acknowledge that so many of the people who have served faced much more difficult circumstances than I did. But I identify with the sort of intensity of his interior life. For me, that was that was what I wanted to focus on. Now, my own experience varies in some degree to the intensity that he goes through, the difficulty that he faces. But I did feel like I was in a position to explore those feelings, to imagine myself into that.
And I guess one of the themes, as I read it, was the loss of a moral compass, the loss of the ability to be compassionate. And I want you to read from the book a scene where Murph and Bartle are kind of staked out with their unit, and there is a car approaching that Bartle can see through his scope, and people, not he, but other people, start shooting at the car. And as the car comes close, it's clear that there was an older woman in it and a man, and the woman is dead. And Murph starts out by saying, and I apologize for the language here, but basically he says, "Holy S-H-I-T, that bitch got murdered." And I'm asking you to read from there.
There was no grief or anguish or joy or pity in that statement. There was no judgment made. He was just surprised, like he was waking from a long afternoon nap, disoriented, realizing that the world has continued, uninterrupted, in spite of the strange things that may have happened while you slept. He could have said that it was Sunday, as we did not know what day it was, and it would have been a sudden thing to notice that it was Sunday at a time like that. But he spoke the truth either way, and it wouldn't have mattered much if it had been Sunday. And since none of us had slept in a long time, none of it really seemed to matter much at all. Sterling sat down behind the wall next to the machine gun. He waved us to him and took a piece of pound cake from the cargo pocket on his trousers as we listened to the final bursts of nervous firing peter out. He broke the dry cake into 3 pieces. "Take this," he said. "Eat." The smoke rose and began to disappear. I watched the old woman bleed on the side of the road. The dust blew in languid waves and began to swirl slightly. We heard shots again. Beyond a building, a small girl with auburn curls and a tattered sundress stepped out toward the old woman. Errant bullets from other positions kicked up the dust around her in dry blooms. We looked to Sterling. He waved us off. "Someone get on the net and tell them it's just a kid," he said.
Okay. That's Kevin Bowers reading from his book, The Yellow Birds. And Kevin, I guess it gets to the absurdity of watching somebody being shot and killed before your eyes, and then you turn and you eat a piece of pound cake. At what point, you having been in a combat situation, when does that start to happen? Is it different for different people, or does it happen rather quickly because you see so much?
I think the shock of it is immediate, but because you're often in a situation where you are exhausted and hungry, your kind of instincts are still operating, even though emotionally you may be overwhelmed with disgust or horror. And in this scene, it was I wanted to kind of explore the notion of what is often referred to as collateral damage, and it's such a almost an antiseptic term. It's clinical in a way, and even for a soldier, when you do see the reality of that, it can be shocking. But in a way, it is, as you said. I mean, it is. There is a process of that can become normal, and that's a dangerous place to be.
And Bartle and Murph, at this point in the book, they have developed a kind of algorithm, like, okay, they're counting different people who have died, and it's basically like, well, it's not us, so if it's them, they have this strange count that almost seems to predict in their minds that they are going to make it.
That's true, yeah. I mean, I think it's, for them, it's almost a superstition, almost a religion, like the survival mechanism. They've fixated on the 1,000th casualty, and they have this idea that as long as they're not the 1,000th casualty, they'll be okay. So there is sort of an exploration of the idea of fate, how you control your own survival, how much control you have on that, over that.
And was that something...
The idea of being powerless in the face of the extraordinary circumstances they find themselves in.
It reminded me almost of a child counting the steps and not stepping on the crack for whatever purpose, but doing it very sincerely to control things that are beyond our control.
Right. No, and I think in normal everyday life, but certainly in extreme circumstances, we look for ways, areas where we can assert our own agency, and even if it's something that may seem utterly ridiculous, and of course that will actually have no effect on whether they survive or not, it is something that they latch onto, and it's something that they feel like they have a certain amount of control over.
Is that something you did when you were over there trying to predict whether or not you were going to make it and be okay?
I don't know if it's something that I was conscious of at the time. I mean, certainly there were moments where I was intensely afraid, things like that. But looking back, and I would say a large portion of the book is sort of dedicated to the idea of how we sort through our experiences and our memories. So thinking back, I did wonder what was different about my experience. Why did I emerge from that experience unscathed where others didn't? And I know certainly it wasn't because I deserved it anymore. You just wonder, does it come down to physics and geometry? Is it purely chance? That was something that I reflected, spent a lot of time reflecting on when I came back, and I wanted to sort of have that element be present in the book.
That's Kevin Powers. We have a short break coming up. Kevin has written The Yellow Birds, a novel about the Iraq War. He also is a veteran who fought in Iraq. If you want to join the conversation, maybe you're a veteran or maybe you've already read the book or some of the glowing reviews it's getting, 1-888-477-9499 is our number. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. Coming up, more with Kevin Powers here on Radio Times. Stay tuned.
The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show supports WHYY and Circles the Square in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square at 18th and Walnut, Friday through Sunday, September 14th through 16th. Open Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., Saturday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Featuring original artwork from over 140 locally and nationally recognized artists. A variety of paintings, prints, drawings, and sculptures will be exhibited. The Rittenhouse Square Fine Art Show. Details available at rittenhousesquareart.org.
This Week in This American Life, Joe had all kinds of schemes to make money in the most unlikely of places, and then he came up with one that just seemed too good to be true. But there was one problem. To collect the money, he'd have to be dead.
All we need to do is replace the necessity of the investor having to die with someone else.
Which he did this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Reporters of color were shut out of this year's presidential debate, so the Spanish-language TV network Univision will host two forums of its own. President Obama and Mitt Romney are both in, and moderator Jorge Ramos thinks he knows why.
That's the new rule in American politics. No one can make it to the White House without the Hispanic vote.
More on this next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscoane. We're talking with Kevin Powers, who's written a novel called The Yellow Birds about the Iraq War, and he's also an Iraq veteran, and he's getting glowing reviews for this book. And Kevin, before our break, we were talking a bit about the characters in your book, Murph and Private Bartle, witnessing a what is sometimes called collateral damage, where civilians are killed in a battle. The witnessing of such things, is there a moment as a soldier in conversations with your fellow soldiers where you know this is going to stick with me? I'm gonna move on in this moment because I have to, but you kind of know you're going to pay for this on some level.
I mean, I'm not sure if I can, personally, if I can identify a specific moment like that, but I think there is, for me, there was a sense that things were accumulating, and I could feel the weight of those things sort of building and building. I didn't know what the consequences of that would be at the time, but I was aware that I was changing, that my outlook on the world was changing, that something was happening to me that I would carry probably for a very long time.
And I want to talk about Sergeant Sterling, who is another character in the book. And if we're talking about this moral compass, he certainly seems to have lost it. But then, on the other hand, he truly and absolutely cares for his soldiers, and he would step in front of a bullet for any one of them. So on some level, he's still a good guy.
I think that's true, and it was important to me to try to show, as I mentioned before, to show these characters as individuals, to identify whatever humanity that I had, to be aware of that and to present it, to try to treat them with the compassion that I would give to any other human being. He has been through this experience before, and I sort of see him, the three characters, as existing on a kind of spectrum, if you will, and he's farther down the line. He's sort of latched on to the idea of his own competence as being the thing that will save him, the thing that he has control over is his ability to perform his job well. And that's essentially all that he's able to focus on.
In your book, you have several scenes where it almost seems like they have a dreamlike feel to them. It's a nightmare or an adrenaline-fed dream of sort. Is it because when you're there, you're always in between that stage of being awake and asleep and afraid all at the same time?
I think there's an element of that experience where the intensity of every moment becomes normal. I mean, that becomes, you have to sort of reposition the center of your emotional life, and it becomes heightened in a way that can be very confusing and difficult. But then also, again, as I mentioned, a lot of this, most of the book takes place in the memory of the narrator, and it's the process by which those memories can come to feel as present as the life that he's living day to day, the way they encroach on his everyday experience. The way that they're often more intense and feel more important even than the life that he's living after he returns.
And the narrator says how much he hates the character we just spoke about, Sergeant Sterling, but at the same time, how much he needs him to get through the next battle, through the next firefight. Talk about that role of leaders and also looking at your peers in just getting through.
Right, and I think in Bartle's case, he recognizes the process that we just talked about, the way that Sterling is sort of having his moral center and his humanity slowly chipped away at by virtue of the long experiences that he's endured, and I think Bartle, at the same time, recognizes how he may ultimately save. That Sterling may ultimately save Bartle's life, that he is competent, that he knows what he's doing, that he can trust in him. But that also he's terrified that if he continues, if he has to experience this more, that he may end up having his own humanity chipped away. This may be the kind of necessary result. This may be the way you need to act to get through. And I think that prospect makes him very afraid.
Mm. And when you were in Iraq, just to reflect a bit on your experience and that of your fellow soldiers, were they conscious of that? Were they trying to avoid becoming that, completely losing who they were and being changed forever?
You know, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I can really speak for anybody else. I just know in my own experience, mm-hmm. Being aware, as we talked about earlier, being aware that these weren't things that I would be able to easily forget about, that they would affect me. I didn't want to lose my, I didn't want to become cynical. I didn't want to lose my sense of compassion, those things. So yeah, certainly that was something that I was aware of to a degree, but it's later when you get home and you have all that time to reflect that those challenges really start to present themselves very strongly.
I want you to read another part of the book here, still in Iraq. The Bartle and Murphy have just kind of spent a private moment relaxing a bit and also watching a medic, but then there is a mortar attack, and here is Bartle's account of experiencing that mortar attack.
I didn't count the mortars. All measures of time and increment were discarded like childish superstitions. Crump, crump, crump. The earth shook, and the vibrations ran up the heels of my palms where my hands, now bloodied, desperately tried to push the earth into a ridge in front of my face. They flowed up to my elbows and shook the buttons of my blouse, which dug like rivets into the ground. Get small, Private. You get small and stay small. There was a lull, brief and intangible, like a small circle of sunlight falling absently through the clouds. A deep constriction occurred in my chest, under my breastbone, as if my ribs had turned into fingers clutched in an arthritic fist. I was still prostrate on the ground. My face and body had plowed a small plot in which I lay. Dirt in my mouth, ground against my teeth, coating my tongue with a thin particulate film. It was in my nose, too. Each breath was thick and structural, and I felt for a moment like I was falling, like falling into wakefulness after dreaming your fingers have slipped from their last nocturnal handhold. I listened for an all clear, but heard nothing. This is my life again, I thought. I'm not going to die in a grave dug by my own bleeding hands.
That's Kevin Powers reading from his book, The Yellow Birds. And Kevin, everywhere in the book, you take us into the landscape. So you're inside the character's mind. You're experiencing what they are experiencing. And then you see the clouds, you see the stars, you see the horizon. Describe a bit about how you use that tool of kind of flashing and bringing the landscape and making it part of the narrative.
Right. And I think for the narrator, there's a profound sense of dislocation, of just feeling completely uprooted, and not just in the physical sense, but also emotionally, even spiritually, that he's not grounded in any way. And I think there's a kind of a desperate need to identify his place in the world. So he's observing these things. And again, I think the way that it's presented, the way that he's looking back and remembering, that's also a large part of that need to remember, the need to sort through those memories, to try to order them, comes down to him sort of identifying his place in those experiences and just trying to get some firm picture of it so that he can then try to make sense of them.
And in your own memories, do you have such distinct images in your head of birds over fields, of orchards, of fires in the distance?
There are. I know I do have memories of very surreal moments of a kind of wonder and awe, even that sort of flashes of the significance of what I was experiencing, and I don't know that I was even fully conscious of what was happening in those moments, but they stuck with me. And again, you know, looking back, they seemed profound. I mean, I certainly wouldn't describe them as beautiful, but they did seem awesome in a way.
Mm. And I think something you communicate as well is the bizarre sense that while you are doing this, while you're in a mortar attack or shooting or almost being killed somewhere else, somebody is in this country, in Iraq, sitting around a fire, and somewhere else, somebody in America is leading a completely normal life, not having a clue what you're up to at this moment.
I think that's true, and you know, I think, I mean, even as somebody, I returned from the war in 2005, so I certainly understand. I mean, the information that's available to us about both Iraq and Afghanistan, the journalists do such an amazing job of providing us with that access, you know, and they do that at great personal risk to themselves. But the sheer amount of material that we're presented with, it can be difficult to maintain your level of engagement with that, and it can be sort of easy to become inured to that, and the desire to look away, the temptation to look away, is one that I even felt myself, because, you know, as we're all aware, I mean, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan have continued long after even my own service ended.
Yeah, and I guess one of the questions, you know, how was it over there, is one that can never be answered unless you were there yourself.
That's right. No, I mean, and when I was asked that question, which I often was, and I'm sure that, the other soldiers and Marines and sailors can identify with being asked, what was it like over there? For me, I tried to think about what would be an analogous situation, and I really wasn't able to find one. But what I do believe, and what I tried to explore in the book is those sort of the emotional core of that experience. And I thought that if I focused on that, I could communicate that. Everybody understands what it's like to be confused. Everybody understands what it's like to be angry and afraid. So, you know, I thought that if I rooted the book in the kind of emotional life of this narrator, that people would be able to identify, and hopefully reading it would be, a valuable experience for whoever happened to be reading it.
And you say war is only like itself.
I think that's true, and in kind of a casual way, war is often used to, you know, as a comparison for other things. I mean, I think, you know, football season just started, and there are all these ways in which war is presented as a kind of equivalent. You know, these are warriors, and it's a battlefield, and that sort of thing. But really, you know, it's not true. So, I mean, just looking at an example, the scene that I first read, I mean, one of the awful, horrible things. There are no lines. There's no line you cross where you can identify, okay, now we are all on the field of play. That doesn't exist in modern warfare.
And in the book, there is a scene where a reporter asks a group of the guys, basically, so what's it like when you're out there and you're getting shot at and it's about to all hell is about to break loose. And Murph says, well, it's about like you're getting into a car accident. Describe his answer.
Right. No, I mean, he's trying to think of something as just these moments of where time seems to do strange things with your experience, the moments of recognizing your own powerlessness. And, thankfully, I haven't been in very many car accidents, but, you know, there is that moment where you realize that it's happening, but you also recognize that that there's nothing that you can do about it. And you kind of have to just give yourself over to that experience.
And as you were writing the book, did it unsettle you? It certainly unsettled me, and I've never been there.
I think it did. No, but I mean, I felt some responsibility to present you know, the truth as I understand it, the questions that I had. I mean, certainly I don't make any claims that this book will is indicative of every single soldier's experience, but no, it's just you know, as a record of the questions that I have, my my attempts to reckon with them. No, I wanted to make sure that that I wasn't holding anything back, because one, I mean, that I felt that would be dishonest, and you know, as a writer, I didn't think it would be productive. You know, I wanted to make sure that I was taking, you know, following my imagination to its limits, trying to look, get as close as I could to the roots of those experiences. I mean, there were moments where it was difficult and uncomfortable, absolutely.
Yeah. And another major theme in the book is guilt, because Bartle promises, basically, to take care of Murph. That's something he ultimately isn't able to do.
That's right. No, and I mean, and again, this this idea of what responsibility do you have? How do you measure your responsibilities for your own actions? How do you measure that against this profound feeling of powerlessness and lack of agency? There's a tension there and a conflict there that can be really difficult to deal with, and you know, and particularly for Bartle, having made this this promise that he never would have had the power to keep, you know, whether it would have been fulfilled or not, it wouldn't have been because he had the power to make it happen. Yeah, it can be you know, for him, it's a very difficult thing to settle.
Is there also that bit of survivor's guilt? You spoke earlier about your own feelings about having come back when others did not. So is that part of it?
Absolutely, of course. Yeah, no, and so definitely there's that element of it. Thinking, you know, I mean, Bartle, you know, says on a couple of occasions in the book that he has this desire to be ordinary. You know, he feels like he's an ordinary person, an ordinary soldier. But somehow he feels this weight, this responsibility of having survived, of having not been grievously wounded. And so he's trying to kind of account for what it is in his experience that allowed that to happen. He certainly doesn't feel responsible for his own survival even. So he's trying to sort through those feelings are incredibly difficult for him.
That's Kevin Powers. He has written a novel called The Yellow Birds, and he is himself an Iraq veteran, and the book is about the Iraq War. We'll talk more after a short break here on Radio Times, and if you have a question for Kevin Powers, give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back after a short break.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. More than 20,000 women will be diagnosed with ovarian cancer this year. The single most important risk factor for ovarian cancer is family history of the disease. Fox Chase offers risk assessment, genetic counseling, and a comprehensive range of treatment options. Patients have access to Fox Chase's multidisciplinary team-based approach, along with current clinical trials. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of the Temple University Health System.
On the next Fresh Air, a behind-the-scenes look at President Obama. We talk with Michael Lewis about his article, Obama's Way, in Vanity Fair. Lewis was given an unusual amount of access to the president, traveling with him, interviewing him, even playing a game of basketball with him. Lewis is the author of Moneyball, Liar's Poker, and The Big Short. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look back at the Station nightclub fire in Rhode Island that happened 9 years ago. One lawyer says the club was built to burn. Also, the new film Arbitrage tells the story of a successful hedge fund manager who put his life and career in jeopardy by a series of morally questionable decisions. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Kevin Powers about his novel about the Iraq War, The Yellow Birds. And Kevin himself is a veteran and served in Iraq in 2004 and 2005. And Kevin, I want to get now to the experience of coming home. And I want you to read another part of the book where Private Bartle, one of the main characters, has returned to Virginia. He's been home, but he cannot find his way. He's completely disconnected, spends his days drinking, sleeping, and just staying at home. And on this day, he has ventured out to the river, and he's watching his friends, one of the guys actually, his former best friend, having a fun day at the river. So read that part for us.
Luke and the rest of the boys and girls still splashed in the water, taking turns diving from the broad gray rocks into a little draft of current that swept them 10 or 20 feet downstream like an amusement park ride. They were beautiful. I had to resist the urge to hate them. I had become a kind of cripple. They were my friends. They were my friends, right? Why didn't I just wade out to them? What would I say? "Hey, how are you?" they'd say, and I'd answer, "I feel like I'm being eaten from the inside out. And I can't tell anyone what's going on, because everyone is so grateful to me all the time, and I feel like I'm ungrateful or something, or like I'll give away that I don't deserve anyone's gratitude, and really they should all hate me for what I've done, but everyone loves me for it, and it's driving me crazy." Right.
And it really painfully speaks to that complete disconnect that the character feels from his peers. And this begins on the flight home in the airport. He's waiting for a connecting flight, and the bartender wants to give the character free drinks because he's a hero.
Right, no, and I think for him, there is this extraordinary disconnect. I mean, the gravity of what he's experienced, the kind of intensity of the violence that he found himself in, that doesn't seem to warrant thanks. So he has a really difficult time accepting those sort of gestures of gratitude and things like that, because all that he can see is the kind of the way that it's damaged him and damaged the people that he cares about, and it doesn't seem like anything to be celebrated.
And in the going on after the scene that you just read, the character says, "You know, what am I going to talk to you about if I'm thinking of dogs that are stuffed with explosives and corpses that are laying around exploding and people losing their limbs? What do I have in common with you swimming in the river? Do you have, you know, is there anything in common, or is that experience just so profoundly separating?"
Well, I mean, I think it can be separating, but probably even more importantly is this fear that it will be separating. So this idea that if you let somebody know the kind of turmoil that those experiences have caused you, that there is, I mean, in a sense, it's a fear of rejection like any other fear of rejection, but it's rooted in this, you know, having seen the kind of extreme this extreme awful part of the human experience, this idea that people will want to keep you at arm's length and more than arm's length. So yeah, the sense that you will be rejected, this idea that how am I gonna connect to my friends, to my old life, does that even exist anymore? That's a really big concern for him.
And there's also Bartle's mother, who sees the son coming back, who is obviously not the same. She knows it, but yet she seems powerless in changing anything about the situation.
Right, and I don't know what kind of experience you would have to feel competent in dealing with the challenges that they're presented with, but neither of them feel equipped to to bridge the gap that they both recognize, but they're sort of not are able to articulate. You know, so for her, she desperately wants to reach out to him, but she doesn't. She simply just doesn't know how.
And what was your homecoming like?
There are certainly the challenges. We talked a little bit earlier about the way that the intensity of those experiences become normal. And I know for me, when I came home and if you will, life was normal again, I felt like something was out of balance in a way. That I had this expectation that I needed to be alert at all times, and even if it wasn't a conscious thing, there was this kind of physical level of alertness and intensity that I thought, you know, even if I didn't think, that my body just sort of felt was necessary, that it took time for that to kind of recalibrate to the rhythms of normal life. And it can be very confusing, and it can be difficult, and it can be hard to explain to those people who love you. So there are challenges, and there are certainly dangers.
What did you need when you came back? What did you need from those who loved you, from those around you? And what did you need for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I needed time. I needed space. Sure, I needed the attempt at understanding, the kind of not necessarily, any sort of insistence that I talk about it, but I had friends and family that just said, "Hey, you know, we're here and we care about you, and we're so happy that you're home." You know, and just knowing that there was that availability, that when I was ready, if I wanted to talk, or if I wanted to, you know, express something about my experience, that was an option.
Do you generally?
So that was really important.
Do you generally like for people to know that you're a veteran? I mean, you won't have a choice after all this is over, but
that's true.
Before the book came out, is this something you shared or no?
No, I mean, not really. It often would come up just in the sort of nature of conversations that people have, but, no, it wasn't something that I kind of presented to the world as part of who I was. And I think that was, a function of not wanting that experience to define me. And I think it, you know, as we've talked about, there can be a challenge of looking at a veteran and seeing only that aspect of their life, and I didn't want that. So, no, I didn't keep it a secret or anything, but it certainly wasn't something that would come up if you sort of first met me or something like that.
And how is it different when you are around fellow veterans who've been through similar experiences? Is there that sharing or that kind of base understanding that you have of each other?
I think there is. For me, those kind of interactions, often you don't even need to say anything. There's just a very basic fundamental understanding that can be that can provide a kind of comfort that, particularly right when you get back, feels so rare and precious.
How old were you when you came back?
I had turned 24 by then, yeah, so I was 24.
And then you enrolled in college?
I did. I spent some time working before I went back to college full-time, but I'd started taking classes part-time.
So then you were kind of like the age of a sergeant is to his to his soldiers in terms of your classmates, right? Because they must have all been 18 or so.
No, that's true. Yeah, I was a little bit older than my peers. Sure.
And did your experience as a soldier come up in college at all, or again did you rather not talk about it?
I didn't talk about it all that much. I mean, you know, certainly I made friends, and as I got to know them better, you know, they would ask me, you know, about my experience, and I, you know, shared it with the people that I trusted and whose friendship I valued. But I think it informed I'm not sure if I probably studied a little harder. I think I probably valued the opportunity more than I might have when I was younger. So yeah, I mean, I think there was it contributed to that experience in a certain way.
Are you at all overwhelmed at the reaction your book is getting? I mean, the reviews, I have to tell you, I just stumbled almost literally across your book, read it, then I thought, wow, this is pretty amazing. And when I Googled it, I was just blown away by what people were saying about it and how they compared it to some of the best-known classic war novels that we have.
Yeah, so the answer is yes, it is.
A little overwhelming.
It is a little overwhelming, but you know, I think back. You know, we talked about when I started the book. I was working at a job I didn't particularly like very much. I would work 8 hours and come home and spend time with my wife, who was then my girlfriend, and I would stay up late in the night writing. And I think the best that I allowed myself to hope for then was that perhaps one person might read what I was working on and identify with it or find it to be a valuable experience. So, no, I'm extraordinarily grateful that people seem to be connecting with it.
Are you at all concerned? I can sense that, or at least I'm sensing that you are a rather private person, that you're not enjoying about talking about your personal experience in Iraq. So are you at all concerned that this will have people dragging this out of you on some level, like I've been trying to?
No, I think it's probably true that I am by nature a little more private than outgoing. But I'm happy that people seem to have an interest in the book, and I understand that based on the fact that I have this experience, that people will be interested in that as well. So
are you hoping or are you hearing it all from other soldiers? Because I feel like sometimes there's that challenge where you want to get it right. I mean, obviously, you're not describing every soldier's experience, but I'm sure you have some kind of wish to have it be authentic.
Well, that's true. And I mean, for me, one of the reasons that I chose to tell the story in the way that I did was because I wanted to present it as one experience, as just one example of a possible experience of being in that war and then coming home, and not to make any claims on anybody else's experience. So there are other veterans who are writing, and I'm sure who will continue. I mean, David Abrams just came out with a book called Fobbit. Brian Turner, who is, I think, a really incredible poet, has been writing about the war. So, I mean, I felt responsible to tell the story that felt true to me. And I'm sure as other people engage with this book and as other veterans engage with other books and they begin or continue to write their own experiences, they'll provide other kind of other facets of that. I know I've had some, it only came out yesterday, so I haven't had that many veterans who have read it yet, but I've had some messages of encouragement and people who say that they're looking forward to reading it, and I obviously really appreciate that.
And you're left, when you finish the book, I felt that I was left with a lot of questions. And I wasn't quite sure what really happened to the main character. I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen to him. Is that intentional, or should I read the book again and maybe find the answers? I mean, I feel like I really want to ask you some direct questions, but of course I can't because then I'll give away half the stuff in the
right.
book. But it made me want to look you up and just send you an email and say, hey, what happened to that guy, really? Is that the reaction you wanted?
Well, sure. I mean, I think... you're certainly more than welcome to read the book again, but for me, because such a large part of the book is this one narrator, John Bartle, dealing with the memories of his experience and the kind of unreliable nature of those memories, and he's trying to make these arrangements to try to take all that vast material that he's forced to deal with and order it in such a way that he can understand it. So, my feeling at the end of the book is that he hasn't arrived at any particular kind of order, but he's getting a grasp of how that might happen for him. I understand. I mean, I don't think there are any definitive answers at the end of the book. And, even for me writing it, I felt like I didn't arrive at any definitive answers to the questions that I had, but I hoped, and I hope for readers, the questions will emerge in some sharper degree of clarity.
And Kevin, just about 30 seconds left. So what's next for you? Poetry, more novels? What are you thinking?
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a collection of poetry that I'm working on finishing up, and I've started some very preliminary work on what I hope will be my second novel.
All right, and that's Kevin Powers. He has a first novel called The Yellow Birds, and it's about the Iraq War, and he himself is an Iraq veteran, and the novel is getting glowing reviews. And Kevin, we wish you all the best of luck.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for being on Radio Times. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Marty Moskowain is back tomorrow. I'm Mike and Scott filling in, and thank you for listening.